Hola, soy Tania Barson, comisaria en jefe de MACBA. I'm going to give the tour today in English. I hope that's what everyone expects. Good, good. People are nodding. Phew. So I will do my best to take you round and stop in various places, but probably not everywhere in the displays. And it's very busy today, so we'll do our best. And particularly the beginning, the rooms are smaller, so let's see how it goes. So this is a new presentation of the collection of MACBA. We decided to change the manner of showing the collection from the last few years, where we've been making essentially exhibitions from our own collection, thematic exhibitions from our own collection. And to go back to a way of showing the collection that really announces itself much more as a collection, because we wanted to put it really at the heart of our new work in the museum. And that's also why we've given it the middle floor, the first floor, and why we've also gone back to chronology. So it's a chronological presentation of the collection, and we begin in the 20s. In fact, the first room talks about the moment around 1929-30, and then we come all the way up to the present day. So it's roughly 9 decades of work. And that's why we've called the display a short century, or un siglo breve. And we decided to begin with one piece out here as a kind of book cover for the displays, a front page for the displays. And this is a new acquisition for the collection, so it's just arrived. And it's by an artist called Leonor Antunes, who is Portuguese, but actually now, and for the last quite a few years now, has been living and working in Berlin. And the reason we chose this, apart from it being a new work that we wanted to highlight, is that Leonor's work is all about establishing a different chronology of art in the 20th century, primarily, through her work and through the references that she makes and the homages that she pays to artists that are important to her. And this piece is of a series that she calls collectively Annie, and they're dedicated to the artist Annie Albers, who was married to Joseph Albers and who together were key members of both the Bauhaus in Germany in the 1930s and then also of Black Mountain College in the United States in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, and who also had a lot of activity in Latin America. So they traveled a lot within Latin America, and so has Leonor. And yet also this work pays reference to another artist who's important in our collection, which is the Venezuelan artist Gago. And we'll see a work later on by Gago. But in general, Leonor's work is about establishing a new chronology, a new canon, or challenging the existing canon of 20th century art, particularly through the work of women artists. And both Annie Albers, of course, and Gago, Gertrude Goldschmidt, were women, and really important within their context. So they were leading artists within their context, but they were also women. So there is another narrative possible of modernism through the work of women and through the work of artists working in places like Latin America, in places like Venezuela. So that's why we thought that her work signaled something important about what we're also trying to do through the collection and through this presentation of the collection. So let's go to the first room. So this room contains some of the earliest works that we have in the collection, and they date from the mid-20s to the early 1930s. We've actually just acquired a portfolio of works by Annie Albers, and these two prints at the beginning of the room are by Annie. Both she and her husband came to Barcelona in 1929 because Barcelona was hosting that year the International Exposition, or the Exposition Internationale of that year. And that was the moment when the modernist architect Mies van der Rohe designed a pavilion for that temporary exhibition that was taken down after the exhibition, but then it was recreated in the 1980s. But we begin with photographs of the original. So you can go and see the reconstruction of the pavilion. It's near Montjuic. But we have photographs from the era. And both Joseph and Annie Albers paid a visit to Barcelona in order to come and visit particularly this pavilion, because they knew Mies van der Rohe through the Bauhaus. So what this room talks about is a moment when Barcelona was connected to an international avant-garde. And we start with a white cube space, because that's where we find the first introduction of this style of white monochrome backgrounds and white monochrome architecture, this kind of style of modernist architecture, which was developed alongside the earliest modernist art. So alongside Annie Albers's work, we have a group of works, sculptures and reliefs by another South American artist, Joaquim Torres Garcia, who came to Barcelona actually earlier than this period, in the 19-teens, and then went and worked in various places in Europe, including Paris. And these, in fact, date to his Paris moment, but he's also very connected with this city, and with this city. And he's important because he signals perhaps one of the earliest examples of a challenge to a Eurocentric view of modernism. In fact, he was born in Uruguay, and in his later career, in fact, in 1934, he returned to Uruguay, to Montevideo, and he established a school there, introducing a kind of modernist styles into Latin America, but he blended it with a language drawn from pre-Columbian art. So he created a kind of Amerindian Latin American modernism for the very first time, and that was influential on many subsequent generation of artists in Latin America. We also have key works here by Alexander Calder, the American artist, both from the early 1930s, and he's important because he was in contact with some of the key architects in Barcelona. We have examples of their letters, exchange of letters. So what we're tracking here is a kind of contact in the late 1920s and early 1930s between Barcelona and a really important international avant-garde of modernism. It's not going to last, however, and what we know with hindsight is that in the mid-1930s, we come to the Spanish Civil War, and this moment of kind of optimistic and utopian modernism comes to an end in Spain, at least. So what we're trying to do, actually, in each of the rooms is to create very different contrasting experiences, so that you can get a sense of the flow of time through the change of your context. And I think the change from this room into the next is quite marked. Let's see how busy it is in the next room, because it's quite small. If it's busy, we'll move to the following room and I'll talk about it in the room after, once you've been able to see it. In this room, what we're really addressing is the outbreak and the duration of the Civil War between 1936 and 1939. And as you can see, we've created a wallpaper based on political posters created during that conflict. And then we actually have put some original posters, some posters from the era, framed on top of it. And the idea here, combining this with newsreel footage, documentary footage, and photographs of a pavilion in the International Exhibition in Paris in 1937, is to talk about the Spanish Civil War as also a war of images. So a lot of the ideological dispute was conveyed through images and through posters pasted up in the streets. So this is what we have here. But also, they demonstrate how political posters at the time were paying attention to radical typography, new techniques of design that actually had been developed in many, many respects in Russia during the early 1920s, 19-teens, 1920s, following the revolution there. So this idea here is really to get a sense of the bombardment of images, and that's why we've created this intense and rather claustrophobic space. So here we again introduce a different way of showing the work, a different environment for you to see the work. And here we've moved to the post-conflict era. And in a way, we're talking both about the post-Spanish Civil War, but we're also talking about post-World War II as well. So, of course, the mid-century was a time of huge conflict throughout the world, throughout Europe. So here we're addressing the era that follows that, the late 1940s, 1950s, and 60s. And we start with the vestiges of figuration in art, in this series of photographs of graffiti made in the street, anonymous graffiti, that was photographed by the photographer Bressaille, mostly in Paris, but also in other cities. And that's combined with a series of plaster maquettes for sculptures by Joan Miró, the Catalan artist Miró. And what we're trying to introduce here is the last kind of aspects of a figuration that had begun in the 1920s and 30s, a kind of surrealist-based figuration, that was then moving towards abstraction in this period. And what happens in the post-war period is that two styles of abstraction begin to dominate. One is an expressionistic, gestural abstraction, what's called informel art, and the other is a continuation of the language of the utopian abstraction from the pre-war era, this kind of international utopian style, which is a geometric abstraction. And that continues in different ways after the war as well. So what we have here are two examples of that, and an example of a acrylic and metal sculpture by Constant, who was also both an artist and a radical architect. And here we have a work by the Venezuelan artist Gago. And this is the kind of work that she was producing from the early 1960s, in fact, through until the late 1970s. This is a piece from the 70s, but it demonstrates very well the kind of work that she was making in this moment. So we're kind of moving towards this conflict between, or what's usually described as a conflict or an opposition between informel abstraction and a kind of geometric or purist abstraction. But what I wanted to do in this room and the following room, which is more or less actually two parts of the same room, is to blur the boundaries a little bit between that, because I think it's a little bit too easy to contrast these two different schools of abstraction in the post-war period. And through the center of this double room, we created a wall which is housing a group of ceramics. It's kind of a strange thing within our collection, but we have this group of ceramics by an artist called Antoni Cumele, who is from here, from Catalonia, which demonstrates this sort of blend quite well through the simplicity, the formal economy of his pots, but the informel abstract surfaces that he created with the glazes. So we have the kind of unification of both of these differing schools of abstraction in this other medium of ceramic. And we did want to introduce other media here because this was a moment when artists met with practitioners from different schools, particularly in Barcelona. Artists, as I said, Constantine is also an architect. Diego trained as an architect. And if we go into the next room, I'll talk about some of the artists there who were meeting together. And so in this room, we actually have borrowed from the Design Museum in Barcelona a group of modernist furniture, which is connected with movements here in Spain. So this is the kind of modernist furniture that artistic movements and design movements here in Spain were making, and in Barcelona were making at the time. This chair is by a group called Equipo 57, or the 57 group. It was founded in 1957, and they were a group of both artists and designers, so they were blurring the boundaries between different forms. Here we have two prints by Annie Albers's husband, Joseph Albers. Usually described the other way around. And there are two more prints by Annie over there. And they're incredibly interesting figures because they also connected with practitioners across different, and collaborated with practitioners from different disciplines. When they traveled during the late 1930s, 40s, 50s in Mexico, they became very close to an important Mexican architect called Luis Barragan. And Annie Albers actually made textiles for Barragan houses. So there's this oscillation also between different disciplines. Here in Barcelona, artists, musicians, and architects, as well as designers, met together. And the other thing that makes Joseph Albers' prints extraordinary is the combination between abstract geometric form in both of these prints and his use of the organic wood grain, which is a kind of contrast to the geometry of the forms that he's imposed there. But he's using very deliberately that wood grain. So whereas we might think that, you know, informal abstraction is closer to the organic and geometry is sort of detached from that, in fact, his works bring these two things closer together and play with those contrasts. We also have important work here by Lucio Fontana, Le Buffet, and Carol Rama, who practiced a kind of geometric abstraction for a very short period. She was much more known as a surrealist artist, but she, for a few years in the 1950s, created this kind of work. And what we're trying to do with this context for displaying the work, also bringing furniture in and ceramics in, is to talk about a kind of domestic context, which is why we've created the carpet space here, and thinking about a kind of collector's home. So we're talking through the manner of displaying these works about a resurgence of the bourgeoisie in the post-conflict era, a kind of another aspect of a kind of the social structure in the post-war period, many of which supported the artists, many of which had kind of radical principles, but nevertheless, there was this kind of re-establishment of a bourgeoisie post-conflict. And I should mention also that we have two of the more important artists from this period in Spain, Antoni Tàpies here, who is from Catalunya, and Jorge Oteizo, who is a Basque artist. And in a way, this is where this confrontation between the informel and the abstract geometric come within Spanish art, and it's between the Catalan and the Basque. And we also have the Ortezza sculpture just outside of Macba on the front of the building as well. So these two figures are kind of giants of Spanish art, and they give us this kind of the opposition, but one that I want to sort of suggest in this display is not so confrontational as we might think. So let's go to the next room. We have to walk back the way we came and go to the next space, which is a sort of circular space, and I'll talk about what we're talking about in that room. So in a way now, what we've come to is what we were thinking about as the hub of our displays, a really crucial central space. And because it's sort of this circular space, that also gave us this idea. And in contrast to thinking purely about one or two decades, there were 2 years, a bit like the first room, there were two principal years that we were thinking about when we were putting together the group of works for this room. And they were 1968 and 1975, both really crucial dates in the narrative of Spanish art, Catalan art, and then mapping out from there into the international context as well. Following the Civil War, as you may know, what happened in Spain was that the nationalists won, under General Franco, and Spain was governed by Franco from then until 1975, under the dictatorship that existed here in Spain. During that period, many artists left, and many went to Paris and then to New York. First to Paris, then to New York. So there were a very significant number of Catalan exile artists during this period. And for that reason, and because they were much more allied to a kind of radical politics, which came from the history of Barcelona and Catalonia's support for the Republicans, the losing side of the Civil War. And they happened to be in Paris at the time of the student protests of 1968. So what we have here are a group of posters from the student protests in Paris in 1968. So that kind of political radicalism of occupying the street is incredibly important for this generation of artists. And these events in Paris were very impactful on them, as was this context of countercultural activity, political activity that prevailed in the 1960s, certainly among avant-garde circles. So this is an important aspect of art here, and this is where we kind of base the beginning of our collection. In a way, the previous rooms are kind of a prologue to where we really think that the Macba collection begins. And we have a few pieces from those earlier areas, but we have this era in depth. And so what we're trying to look through here is the wider context of this political radicalism of 1968. Because of course, it wasn't only Paris where political opposition, countercultural activity, and student protests, or protests that began with students but often also involved workers. So it began in France in many respects, but it also existed in other places, including, for instance, Mexico. And we have a lot of contextual, we have included a lot of contextual material from our archive also in this room, in order to give this greater depth behind the kind of artistic concerns of the time. So we move from different locations. Here we have a magazine which examines the contents of protests in Brazil. 1968 was absolutely crucial under the dictatorship in Brazil. It had begun in 64, but in 1968, there was a really significant crackdown, and many artists left Brazil at that time. And in fact, they tended to go either to Paris or to London. Tucumán Arde, which was a avant-garde protest movement, but linked to a kind of politics of protest around laborers, workers in Argentina. We also have examples of this magazine, Oz, which was produced in London, which was part of the actually quite small countercultural scene in London. There was a countercultural scene, there was a Summer of Love, there was Swinging London in 66, Summer of Love in 67, but by the end there was a much more political sensibility. But it was, in the UK at least, quite a small countercultural movement. And then above that, we have a group of posters which are from the Black Panther movement in the United States. So this is another issue to do with a kind of cultural countercultural activity at this moment, which is to do with racial identity. So the evolution of the civil rights movement into the Black Power movement, from civil rights starting earlier on in the 60s and the Black Power movement beginning in the late 60s and moving into the 1970s. So this is the kind of political shift that we're tracking here. And as I said, the other date that's really crucial here and defines the kind of date parameters for this room is 1975, and that is the year of the death of Franco, which is an absolutely crucial watershed year for not a total change, but the beginning of the change, the beginning of the transition. In what I should say, particularly important in this space, but also throughout the displays, are some other sub-themes, and one of which is both the city and the street. And we have encountered that in earlier rooms through the posters from the Spanish Civil War, or from the street graffiti of photographed by Brassailles. Here it is to do with the street as a domain of political activity and of protest. But we're also thinking about a language of popular culture entering art at this moment, and the beginning of an adoption of a language from comics, also as a means of addressing a wider audience, allied to pop art, of course, but also coming from political magazines, political satire. So the kinds of work that we have included in this room are by artists from Catalonia or from elsewhere in Spain, but they have this very clear political motivation, and they have an aspect of this Catalan pop language to them, but it's not the kind of pop of the United States of Andy Warhol, the glossy and sexy. In fact, those are the words of Richard Hamilton, that pop was glossy and sexy and big business. That's another kind of pop, but the pop of the Catalan artists, whether they were working here in a clandestine way or elsewhere in Paris or later on in the 70s in New York, they were working with a much more politicized pop language. So that's what's going on in this room. So if we move along to the next room, we are going to pick up other artists in the 1970s. So in this room, we've moved to New York, this other context which Catalan artists were also working in this moment. But here we've presented actually the work of just two artists. Hans Hacker, who was a German artist working in New York in this period, and Gordon Matta-Clark, who was from the US, but he had Chilean heritage. His father was the surrealist artist Roberto Matta. And here, again, we're thinking about this kind of context of urban, of the urban city in which artists are working in, the context of the street, but this piece is in this part of the room. This is a single piece, multiple panels from a single piece called the Schapolsky Real Estate. It's a study that Hans Hacker did of the process of gentrification in Manhattan at this moment in the 1970s. So he was looking at the economics and of the transformation of New York during this period. It was a period when the city was changing very rapidly. So this piece, which also introduces a much more conceptual language into the displays, looks in depth at that. And it's a piece that we actually share with the Whitney Museum in New York, so we exchange it. And it's just returned to us, so we wanted to highlight this piece in our new displays. To complement that, we have put a group of works by Gordon Matta-Clark, who was working in a very experimental way in relation, again, to architecture, to the economies of the city and to the processes of gentrification, or of the process of dereliction prior to gentrification. He is very known for some of the works that we're showing here, where he intervenes in the fabric of derelict buildings and actually cuts into them. So the film that is being projected here now is called Splitting, in which he's made a slice vertically through a house and then destabilized it by removing some of the foundation so that it split apart. He was working in relation to architecture. He was interested in experimental architecture. So we have a group of his drawings of kind of sort of fantastical architectures on the other side. And on this side, some of the documentary photography or the photographic pieces that he made from his architectural projects, including Splitting, but also some that he made in Europe. One in Amsterdam, which was called Office Baroque, because he created a circular hole through the middle. So this kind of circularities of Baroque architecture. The way that Matta-Clark was able to intervene in buildings like this was because they had been abandoned. And in Lower Manhattan, he also made a number of projects on the derelict piers in Lower Manhattan, in buildings which were unoccupied, but very rapidly afterwards became occupied. So this is him creating that. So this kind of brings us into the idea here is to bring in another kind of more international context, but again, one which connects with our context here, which is New York in the 1970s. There are two other rooms which deal with the 1970s, but they are quite small, and I think it's a little bit tight for me to go in there, and we're a little bit short on time as well. This is a little bit of a rapid tour. But they both deal with feminist artists working in the 1970s, some from here, but some internationally. So to put in contrast, those artists working in different contexts within the feminist movement. In this large room here, we're dealing with the late 70s and early and the 1980s. So this transition from the 70s to the 80s. We begin with the Guerrilla Girls, who are feminist practitioners as well, so a little bit of a nod to what's going on in the rooms behind. These were originally posters put up in the streets as a form of protest. So this room deals with, again, the street, the context of the street, but also the connection between art and activism. So in a way, it kind of reconnects us with the 1960s room, this kind of political activist movement, but here we're showing it in the 1980s, different era, and the beginning of identity politics, both politics of gender through the Guerrilla Girls, but also one of race through the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. And we've put all three of MACBA's Basquiat's on display here. Basquiat, of course, began as a street artist. He worked as a duo, and his tag was SAMO, or Same Old Shit, it stands for. So his early works in the late 1970s were interventions in the street, taggings, graffiti, and he later moved on to making the expressionistic canvases we see here. We have a work that is a self-portrait, and then also one which investigates music. This work is called King Zulu, and it's making reference to the various different jazz trumpeters, but particularly to Louis Armstrong, who played the role of King Zulu in New Orleans. It's a role that is played during Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and it has this kind of black face, but it's actually played often by an African-American. And Louis Armstrong considered it a huge honor to be chosen to be King Zulu. So this is Basquiat referencing an earlier generation of African-Americans, musicians whom he admired, but also thinking about the ambivalences of race that he was also facing and grappling with. We also have the domain of the street represented by Jenny Holtz's work. These are the inflammatory essays. And again, they were originally posters, fly posters, put up without permission in the street. And each one contains an essay of 100 words that is bombastic in its politically activist language. So inflammatory, as the title suggests. We also have two artists, again from the United States here, George Kondo and Raymond Pettibon, who are both, but in very different ways, playing with the language of popular culture, of comic culture. George Kondo is actually, this is a group of works he made here in Barcelona, and in reference to Spanish art. So we have the reference to Velázquez here, but also many references to Picasso, but they're undermined by the kind of cartoon language that he blends with this. So this is a kind of blending, an undermining of high culture by popular culture. And Raymond Pettibon, who is very associated with the kind of subculture of creation of fanzines, which is also another aspect of the kind of culture that we're tracking here that became influential in artists' work in the 1980s. The two vitrines in this room deal with two other aspects of 1980s culture. One, a magazine that was begun in the late 1970s by Andy Warhol and continued to be edited by him until his death. It then folded a couple of years later, was relaunched, and then later, in fact, last year, it closed in what has been announced for good. So Interview Magazine has, in the last year, come to an end. All of these issues are from the late 70s or early 80s, and they, whilst talking about popular culture, they also introduce this idea of celebrity culture and how influential that was within our own worlds, but also coming from Warhol's idea that everyone is famous for 15 minutes. And I think rather than in the 1960s, in the context of pop art, when he first made those statements, it was really in the 1980s, I think, where we really saw an explosion of what we now know as celebrity culture. And I think it was well represented through the pages of Interview Magazine. And these are various covers, various well-known celebrities, including Blondie, Truman Capote, Sting, Liza Minnelli. This vitrine deals with another aspect of the 1980s, and that's the impact of the AIDS crisis. So this is another aspect of where art and activism met, which was around the AIDS crisis and different artist groups. In particular, General Idea, the prints here for what became their AIDS wallpaper, and various other objects are related to this group, General Idea. But we also have photographs here of Keith Haring making his mural here in Barcelona, which has been remanifested also outside of MACBA. It was on a building that was later demolished, but MACBA, working with the city, remanifested it, and it's the mural is part of our collection. But this is the documentation of when Haring was here, and it is a mural which was supporting the anti-AIDS movement, the support movement for those with AIDS. The other aspect of this room was to really think about the kind of context of what kind of context we wanted to make to experience the art, the kind of bright lights and the bright colors of the 1980s. And that is put in deliberate contrast with the next room, which looks at the 1990s. So in this room, we have a small group of works, which are all in certain respects sculptural, but in fact, move towards an installation art practice. And I think this is something that certainly I recall very much from the art of the 1990s, which was an explosion in what we now know as installation art, and the kind of scale of installation art, and the fact that it draws you inside of it as a visitor. You become part of the work. You actually enter into the work. And that's what's happening here in different ways. We have a work here by the Spanish artist Juan Muñoz, which is these trompe l'oeil curtains and the group of figures and the single figure over here, a very kind of theatrical stage setting with dramatic lighting. And what we wanted to think about here was the kind of the scenography of art of the 1990s, the fact that this theatricality was something that came out of installation art of the time and of what was maybe called post-minimal practice. So the relationship between art and theatricality that minimal art of the 1960s had tried to disassociate itself from was something that artists in the 1990s began to embrace. We also have a major installation here by the Swiss artist, the French artist Christian Boltanski, The Reserve of the Swiss Dead. And one at a time, it is possible to enter this work. So you can go inside and you can see the photographs of the people that it is implied are contained within these metal boxes. So this is a piece about mortality, and it implies the presence of the body, but also we don't really see the body presence. Your body goes inside the work. So this playing with the body, absence and presence, is also something that's very much a part of the work of the 1990s. And this kind of melancholic practice as well. As you may have noticed, everything in this room is monochromatic. It's very subdued. The lighting is theatrical, but it's also very low. The small work on this side of the room is by a Brazilian artist called Valesco Suarez, and it's called Sinners. It implies the presence of the body, not only because it's a piece of furniture, but because on top of this low bench, a very thick layer of wax has been applied. And in the wax, there are the imprints of two knees. In fact, if you go very close, you can see that there are hairs trapped in the wax. So this talks about a kind of spirituality, but maybe one from a Catholic context, such as Brazil, and one where praying is important, but where the notion of sin and of guilt that is implied there is also implied by this work. But of course, whilst we're it makes us think very much about a body, it's also one that has departed. So again, we get this sense of this kind of strange, uncanny presence, absence of the body. And then similar happens in this work over here, a kind of uncanny presence, absence of the body, a kind of prosthetic sculpture by Jana Sterbak. It's actually a prosthetic crinoline, but it's motorized so that it can move around. It's called remote control. So it implies that anyone who goes inside it doesn't have control of their own motions. And the idea of prosthetics, of attachments to the body, became very, I think, frequent in the art of the 1990s. And this, yeah, as I've said, this oscillation between the presence and the absence of the body, this idea of maybe of someone who's just got up from praying, but maybe also the idea of the departed in terms of this Boltanski's work around the Swiss dead. What he talks about in terms of the Swiss, the reason he references the Swiss dead is that he thinks that in our minds, in popular culture, the Swiss are the most neutral and then the most perhaps anonymous of people. So he talks about this as being an ironic piece, thinking about the anonymity, the lack of commemoration of the Swiss, and this being a kind of way of addressing that. So let's go into the final room. What I should say in this room is that each of these rooms that we've constructed around certain years or around certain decades is a version of that moment. The 1990s room is very much a 1990s kind of practice that I remember, but some of my colleagues had a very different experience of the 1990s. And I think none of the rooms, that kind of dilemma of how to summarize it through a small selection of works is more clear than here, which is the 2000s. So this room brings us up to date to the now, but we've only got three works here. So it's a room that takes a certain look at recent contemporary practice through some of the themes and ideas that we think are quite dominant in a lot of work, but are also particularly important for our own collection. We have the work of a Spanish artist here, Carlos Aires. It is both this floor and the video. And in fact, this floor is meant to be walked on. It's a bit like a Carl Andre floor piece, but it looks more domestic. It looks like a piece of parquet flooring. In fact, it recalls the painted wood of the Torres Garcia in the first room, and that was a sort of echo that we wanted to play with as well. But all of the pieces in this floor come from a salvage yard near Cadiz, where boats go that have been used by migrants to cross the Mediterranean. So in this room, the idea of migration, and very specifically the recent migration refugee crisis in the Mediterranean, is the subject matter. And we felt that that was such a hugely important theme that we had to put work that addressed it here, and Carlos Aires' piece, I think, really does that. Alongside that, we have work by an American photographer using a very different language of documentary photography. This is a group of photographs by Alan Sekula, who is one of the leading and most influential practitioners of a documentary practice allied to contemporary art. He actually passed away a few years ago, but is still incredibly influential. This is a series of photographs he took here in Barcelona of the industries that exist along the shoreline of Barcelona, many of them heavy industries. The series is called Methane for All. what he's talking about really is the resources, the industries, and the economics that underpin globalization. So this is the other theme. The other kind of twin theme to one of migration is the economics and politics of globalization and the impact of that on contemporary life. The last piece in this room is by a collective composed of two much younger artists, one from here in Barcelona and one from Amsterdam. The collective is called the Worker Collective, or Werker Collective. And here we see the total absence of imagery. And we only have words, and that's the point behind this piece. It takes the captions beneath photographs from newspapers that describe the photographs and frame those captions. So that what it asks you to do is imagine the image from the caption. And each of these captions has been selected very carefully to talk about aspects of that challenge us in everyday life, including the economics of globalization, political conflicts, the things like the Arab Spring. So recent history is encapsulated in this piece. It isn't shown, but we can reimagine it by reading the captions that are placed here. So this was a way of kind of talking about some of the really big themes that are running through the work of many artists of different generations working today. It isn't really a way of summarizing the work of today, but it talks about some really important things, and also for our location here in Barcelona. And the idea behind all of these displays is to remember where we're speaking from. So we are in Europe, we are in the south of Europe, but maybe the north of the south of Europe, the north of the Mediterranean, the north of the south, and thinking about where we're located in Spain as well. We're located in Catalonia, we're located on the coast, we're located as a Mediterranean port city. So all of these ideas of migration and of globalization impact Barcelona very clearly. Across from this room, in what we call the tower, there is a single film being screened, and that's the last work in the displays. I won't go in there because it's a darkened room and it is a small space. It's a film by a British collective called the Otolith Group, and it sort of complements this room in a way. It's from 2010 and it's called Hydra Decapita. It is mostly images of the sea, the sky and the sea, with a voiceover of one of the members of the Otolith Group talking about an incident that happened in the late 1780s when a ship called the Zong, which was carrying slaves from Africa, got into trouble and the captain decided to throw the cargo overboard. There was a huge court case around the Zong in the UK because the owners of the ship tried to claim insurance for their cargo of goods. But the goods had been human beings. So it talks about the politics of slavery in the 1780s, but also latter-day globalization and the commodification of human beings, perhaps represented by the migration crisis. So it makes the connection between these two things, between the history of the slave trade and modern day globalization, talks about perhaps the way in which slavery, exploitation is not the obverse of modernity, it's actually integral to the processes of modernity. It's actually what's facilitated modernity. The case of the Zong became incredibly important in the abolition of slavery, in the movement to abolish slavery. It took another generation to do it, but it occurred. And the painter Turner which is also mentioned in the film. The painter William Turner made a painting of the Zong in the 1830s, referencing this important case at a moment much closer to the actual abolition of slavery. And Turner felt very strongly against slavery, so he was kind of allied to it. And his painting was shown originally with a poem that he wrote, so which was an anti-slavery poem. So in a way, his work was also a form of protest art. So that very powerful film concludes our presentation of the collection at the moment. And if you have any questions, please do ask me. But thank you for your attention.
Just one curiosity.
Yes.
It would be a next, just an imaginary game, a next room, like it's almost the end of the century.
Yeah.
A new decade, sorry. Next year, what do you think? I know it's an imaginary idea, but what's the direction of the new pieces, the new art?
Well, you raise a very interesting point, and we were already thinking of the next rooms when we were putting this up, because the idea is that actually, not just chronologically, but also as a form of palimpsest, we will change the displays periodically. We will change certain works, but we'll also change certain rooms at different times. So although this is a presentation of the collection, much more as a collection and as the collection that's housed here in MACBA, so in that sense, permanently at MACBA, it's not a permanent presentation. What we want to do is keep it up for much longer, or this structure up for much longer, but we will change it. But of course, yeah, the challenge for curators of contemporary art is, where is art going from here? And that is something that we're thinking about. I think there are many different versions of this room, and we have to think about, yeah, maybe there are many different versions of the rooms to come after this as well. We need maybe more space. That's a kind of controversial point in the city at the moment. But in a way, you know, I think it's not just that development of art. I don't know where we will go from here. I would try and contrast this. I think there are many different kinds of practices that are happening, but I think this room represents very clearly important aspects of contemporary art that MACBA has been tracking in its history. So our collection continues to be built into the future, but some of the themes that we've addressed in these displays are really crucial themes within our collection. I'm not answering your question,
yeah,
am I?
Answering, no.
Okay. I don't know. Yes, yes. I'd have to think about it a lot more. We were thinking about, yeah. I mean, the exciting thing is to follow where art goes from here, and yeah, that's to do with where the artists lead us. And I think it's also really crucial to think that, yeah, we think about the art through the artists and what they tell us. Thank you.